Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Katie Weaver and Anna Mateo. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly brings us one part in an ongoing series about America's presidents. But first, the Higher Education Report.
Students defrauded by for-profit colleges won an important legal victory on Tuesday. A U.S. federal court ruled against a request to delay a policy from former President Barack Obama's administration. The policy makes it easier for those students to get their student loans forgiven. The policy is known as borrower defense and was originally meant to go into effect in July 2017. But current Education Secretary Betsy DeVos said the rule made forgiving loans too easy and was unfair to taxpayers. So she blocked it while attempting to create a new policy in its place. Last month, U.S. District Judge Randolph Moss decided that DeVos's delay was unlawful. This week, he denied a request from an organization representing for-profit colleges to delay the rule even longer.
Julie Murray is an attorney with Public Citizen. She represents the students in the legal action against the education secretary. The rule is finally in effect, Murray told the Associated Press. No more excuses. No more delays. In a statement on Tuesday, Education Department spokeswoman Liz Hill said DeVos respects the role of the court and accepts the court's decision. She added that the department will soon provide information about how the rule will take effect. But DeVos continues to consider the rule to be bad policy and will continue writing a new rule that protects both borrowers and taxpayers, said Hill.
The court's decision means the Obama rule on loan forgiveness could be in effect until July 2020. At that point, the new rule written by DeVos will come into effect. Under the Obama rule, students whose school closed mid-program or shortly after completion will become eligible for immediate loan relief. This will likely help former students of Corinthian Colleges, for example, a company which closed its entire school system overnight in 2015. The U.S. government had found evidence it was defrauding its students. And the following year, several court cases ruled that Corinthian owed millions of dollars to both its debtors and former students. The Department of Education first created the rule governing borrower defense in 1994. Use of the rule was uncommon until the Obama administration made changes to it in 2016, following the closing of Corinthian and other for-profit colleges. The application process for student loan relief became clearer and more developed. The Century Foundation is a policy research organization. Experts with the progressive organization estimate that the court's decision will affect tens of thousands of students at over 1,400 schools. The students will now be eligible for $400 million in immediate debt relief across the nation. Other parts of the rule permit students to apply for loan relief as a group. It also prevents schools from forcing students to sign away their rights to take legal action against their program. And it makes sure that the schools have some financial responsibility to help relieve student loan debt if they close. That way, it is not entirely taxpayer money covering those costs.
Over 100,000 students say their schools have defrauded them. They are currently waiting for the Education Department to consider their applications for loan forgiveness. James Quall is the president of the Institute for College Access and Success. He said the department must immediately stop student debt collections and completely relieve loans of those borrowers whose schools have been shut down. Toby Merrill is the director of the Project on Predatory Student Lending at Harvard University. His organization also took part in the legal action against the Education Department. He said, "This is a major victory for students across this country in the ongoing battle against the Department of Education and the for-profit college industry." But Steve Gunderson described Judge Moss's decision as disappointing. Gunderson is the president of Career Education Colleges and Universities, a group that supports the for-profit college industry. "It will only create further confusion for students and schools," he said. He also urged the Education Department to provide as much assistance as possible while it finishes writing the new rule. The California Association of Private Postsecondary Schools is the organization that requested further delays to the loan relief policy, in addition to DeVos's delays. The group did not return a request for comment from the Associated Press. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Sean Cheshire is a blind cyclist who competed in the 2016 Paralympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. She hopes to take part again in 2020 in Tokyo, Japan. But before that, she had a different goal, hiking the Grand Canyon in the American state of Arizona. Cheshire lost her ability to see after an accident 9 years ago. She has tried to become as independent as possible in the last few years. She said, "For me, being able to walk in the Grand Canyon like that, that's freedom." She said that for a long time, she was in a really dark place and hated being blind. She said that sports and physical exercise gave her another opportunity at living. Earlier this month, Cheshire crossed 68 kilometers of steep and uneven ground in the Grand Canyon. She did so in 24 hours and 15 minutes. That is believed to be a record for a blind hiker. The earlier record of 28 hours was set in 2014. Three friends helped her during the Grand Canyon hike. They walked several steps apart. They guided and warned her of barriers. She listened for and followed the sound of a bell worn by the lead hiker. She used hiking poles for balance. Scott Drum is one of Cheshire's friends. He served as a guide on the hike. "I've learned a lot about myself," he said. "I learned a lot more about the canyon." Cheshire and her friends finished the hike on October 8th. She said as the group neared the end of the trip, "I had a huge ball of emotion welled up in my chest. I cannot believe we just did that." Along with hiking and cycling, Cheshire has also done running, skiing, and rock climbing. "I'd like to figure out everything a blind woman has never done," she said, "and I would like to do that." I'm Katie Weaver.
And now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Each week, we tell about terms and expressions we use in American English. Sometimes we give you the origin or starting point, but oftentimes, language experts do not know exactly how a word or expression came to be. So, there can be many origin stories. Today, we run into just that problem. But it is not about a word or expression, but rather a symbol, RX. A symbol is a sign that represents one or more words. The RX sign is formed by placing a line across the right foot of the letter R. It represents the word prescription and has come to mean take this medicine. In the States, we often see this sign on drugstores and doctors' offices. It also appears on bottles of pills and other medicines. But how did RX come to mean prescription medicine? One common explanation is that RX has Latin roots. Some word historians suggest that RX gets its meaning from the Latin word recipiere, meaning to take. They add that by the late 1500s, the spelling of the word and its meaning had changed. It became recip, meaning a medical prescription. This meaning remained in use until the middle of the 1700s. At that time, people also began to use the word recipe in food preparation, as we do today. Yet the symbol RX and the meaning take this medicine stayed unchanged. Okay, so that origin story is not so interesting. Instead, let's hear another story that also claims to explain the history of RX. Some experts say the sign began 5,000 years ago in Egypt. At that time, people prayed to Horus, the god of the sun. Legend says that when Horus was a child, Seth, the demon of evil, attacked him. When Seth put out the eye of the young Horus, the mother of Horus called for help. Thoth, the god of learning and magic, answered her cries. With his wisdom and special powers, Thoth healed the eye of Horus, and the child was able to see again. The ancient Egyptians used a picture of the eye of Horus as a magic sign to protect themselves from disease, suffering, and evil. Long after the collapse of ancient Egypt, doctors and scientists in Europe continued to use the sign. But over the years, it changed from the Eye of Horus to the sign for Jupiter, the chief god of the Romans. Jupiter's sign looked much like the printed number 4. Over time, that sign also changed. It became the easily recognized letter R with a line across its foot. The sign no longer means help for the sick from an ancient god, but rather medicine to take. So that is what the symbol means, even though we cannot guarantee how it came to be. To make it up to you, we give you a useful medicine-related expression. Now, when a doctor prescribes a patient medicine, it is only for that patient, no one else. Giving someone a taste of their own medicine sounds like the right thing to do. A person is supposed to take the medicine a doctor has prescribed for them. But that is not what this expression means. When you give someone a taste of their own medicine, you treat them as they have treated you. And we almost always use this expression when talking about bad treatment. Let's hear how it can be used.
Great party, Chuck.
Thanks. Hey, can you keep an eye on things here? I need to go and get Natalie.
I thought Michael was giving her a ride.
That's what he said, but he hasn't shown up. She's been waiting at her place for an hour.
Michael has been doing that a lot lately. He promises to do something and then doesn't follow up. Last week we were supposed to go to the movies, but he stood me up, and he didn't even call to let me know he couldn't make it.
He was a no-show for me just last week, too.
You know, one day we should give him a taste of his own medicine. We should agree to do something really important to him, and then never show up.
Having a taste of his own medicine might help, but you know we'll never do that.
I know. Look, you stay here and take care of the party. I'll go and get Natalie.
That would be a big help. Thanks. Be careful on the road.
Always. See you in about 30 minutes.
And that's Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. I'm Ana Mateo.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about William McKinley. He took office in 1897 and was re-elected in 1900. He led the United States into the 20th century. One way to think of McKinley is as a transition president. In the 1800s, lawmakers were mostly concerned with how the country was growing in North America. But during McKinley's government, the U.S. looked beyond its borders. Congress declared war on Spain, the first time the U.S. had fought a European power since the War of 1812 against Britain. The U.S. also took control of overseas territories, annexed Hawaii, and tried to regulate the world's trade with China. Some historians say President McKinley himself wanted the U.S. to increase its international influence. Others argue that he was just answering the country's mood at the time. Either way,
His presidency is often defined by the country's rise as an imperial power. McKinley was the sixth president to come from the state of Ohio. He was the seventh of eight children. Historians describe his childhood as loving and fun. His father owned a small iron factory. His mother raised her children to be honest and polite. McKinley was a hard-working student. He briefly attended Allegheny College in Pennsylvania, but he did not have the money to finish his education there. A few years after leaving that school, he volunteered for the Army on the side of the Union in the Civil War. He served under a man who would later become president himself, Rutherford B. Hayes. The two stayed close throughout their lives. After the war ended, McKinley studied law, became involved in Republican Party politics, married, and had two daughters. His wife, Ida, was an energetic, well-educated young woman from a wealthy family. For a while, she had... Most experts do not think Van Buren was a strong president. However, Silby notes, Van Buren left an important legacy that still operates today. He created the modern U.S. political system. Van Buren's political education began early. His father was a farmer and operated a hotel at a small town in New York State. Lawmakers sometimes visited the hotel. By listening to them, the future president learned about politics. Eventually, Van Buren studied in a law office and became a lawyer. In the first years of his career, he defended farmers who were fighting large plantation owners for their land. As a result, he developed a reputation for helping the common man. Van Buren became a local official, and then a senator, and governor of New York. When he was 24, he married a young woman he had grown up with, but she died of tuberculosis after 12 years, leaving him with four sons. Historian Joel Silby says, although Van Buren did not remarry, he was known as quite charming among the ladies. Van Buren had a gift for politics, that is, developing relationships and forming alliances. Historian Joel Silby says, most people who knew Van Buren liked him. He seemed warm and friendly. He tried to keep his work-related life and social activities separate. It was not unusual to see him exchange handshakes, smiles, and jokes with men who were his political enemies. His ability to make friends became a powerful tool. Before Van Buren, even lawmakers from the same political party operated independently. They had their own beliefs, their own supporters, and their own allies. Van Buren brought them together. First, he identified people who followed the ideas of Thomas Jefferson, support for independent farmers and states' rights. The group had become known as the Democratic Party, although it was in many ways different from the Democratic Party of today. Van Buren organized meetings for Democrats to talk about their political beliefs. He persuaded them to support the same policies, at that time, the policies of Andrew Jackson. Sometimes, Van Buren helped people who supported Jackson's policies. He gave them government jobs. Van Buren also used a series of meetings to choose one presidential candidate for the party. If this process seems clear-cut, it was not at the time. During the election of 1824, for example, a single party had 4 separate candidates for president, 1 for each part of the country. Van Buren's system eventually gave rise to the national conventions that major U.S. parties use today to nominate their candidates. Van Buren also helped create the modern political campaign. In the 1820s, he saw that many state constitutions were lifting some of their voting restrictions. As a result, states were giving more white males the right to vote. Women, and most African American men, were still largely prohibited from voting. Historian Joel Silby says, Van Buren wanted to bring the new voters into the Democratic Party. He decided to improve on the methods that other, smaller groups had used: campaign events, speeches, and organized efforts to bring people to vote on Election Day. Silby explains that these efforts to persuade and energize voters were new to national politics. Now they are some of the major features of political campaigns. In the election of 1840, Van Buren sought a second term as president. This time, his opponents used Van Buren's political techniques against him. Silby says the new opposition party, called the Whigs, used popular speeches and events to portray Van Buren as a failed president. Crowds shouted, "Matty Van is a used-up man." In other words, he no longer had any power or effect in government. Critics also made fun of Van Buren's fine-looking, even fussy clothes. They portrayed him as a rich, elite candidate. They compared him unfavorably to their candidate, a military hero named William Henry Harrison. Yet it was Van Buren who had come from a poor family, and Harrison from a wealthy one. Even so, Van Buren lost the election of 1840. 4 years later, Van Buren again sought the presidency. This time, even Andrew Jackson did not support him. Instead, Jackson backed a man who supported the seizure of Texas and expanding slavery, James Polk. But Van Buren did not permit those defeats to stop his political career. He ran again in the presidential election of 1848. This time, Van Buren withdrew from the Democratic Party he had helped build. He ran instead as the candidate of a new anti-slavery party called the Free Soilers. But even Van Buren's political skills could not persuade voters. He did not win a single state. After losing this final presidential election, Van Buren finally retired. He spent time with his children and grandchildren, traveled, and wrote about his life. At 79, he died of heart failure. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.